in, among other passages, Titus chapter 2 and verse 14 especially, we have a reminder that God has work for us to do. In that verse, it says of Jesus that He gave Himself for us, that He might redeem us from all iniquity and purify unto Himself a people for His own possession, zealous of good works. We are then to be zealous of good works. Now, why is zeal important? Well, number one, there's a whole lot of work for us to do. We have read so many times from Matthew chapter 9 and beginning in verse 36 where it says of Jesus, but when He saw the multitudes, He was moved with compassion for them because they were distressed and scattered as sheep not having a shepherd. We all know people like that. He saith unto His disciples, the harvest indeed is plenteous, but the laborers are few. There's a lot of work to do, and there's not very many people to do it. And not only are we limited with reference to those who will enter into the work with us, but we're also limited with reference to time. In John chapter 9 and verse 4, Jesus says, we must work the works of Him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. There's going to be a time when you don't have the opportunities that you think you have or you think that you ought to have. And there are so many distractions with reference to that work. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 1, Hebrews 12 and verse 1, the writer says, let us therefore also, seeing that we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, lay aside every weight or encumbrance and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Let's set aside the things that would encumber us or that would hinder us in doing the things that we know that we need to be doing. Now, skillful workers have the right tools. And we have been given a toolbox, if you will, by the Lord. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 and 17 tells us this. Every scripture inspired of God is also profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for instruction, which is in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, furnished completely unto every good work. Strong's says that that expression might be equipped fully unto every good work. We have the right equipment in the scriptures, in other words, to do the work that God wants us to do. Now, at my house or even in my car, I have tools that are good tools that apparently I don't need. Anything that has to do with car just about anymore, I don't. Do you know I have one of those little gap gauges? What's a gap gauge? Well, it measures the gap in your points in your distributor. I used to do my own tune-ups. I don't even think I can spell that anymore. You put it on a computer and it does everything that you are supposed to be able to do. Tuning up a car is what it amounts to is driving it into the bay and letting the experts do with it. Well, what am I going to do with a gap gauge? Well, it's an interesting antique. One of these days when they open my storage locker, they'll make $1 million by selling my gap gauge because that's the only use it has. I have another tool in my car. It is a massive wrench. And the only thing that I can think of that it fits is that nut under the ball on my trailer hitch. And it came with the trailer hitch. That's how I got it. And the only thing I can think of to use it for is if somebody tries to get in the car that I don't want in the car, he's going to have a perfect hexagon right in his forehead. Because that's the only thing I can find useful. Another tool that I have that is there's nothing wrong with the tool, except where I have it, it does go thump when I hit a bump. And that explains something to Stan and Susan who went with me one time, and all through the trip they kept saying, what's that thump? What's that thump? Well, I didn't know what it was at the time, but it was that stupid wrench. I've got another tool that is perfectly good. There's nothing wrong with it, but I don't use it very much, and that's my cell phone. Okay, I've been carrying around in my pocket all day, turned off. And you might be saying, well, David, what do you even have if you got turned off? Well, I might need to call somebody who I can't imagine. But the point is, sometimes we have tools that we think are real needs, things that we just believe we can't do without, and yet without them we seem to do fine, and maybe in some cases we do better. And so we need to consider maybe some tools that we think that we need to do God's work, but maybe we don't need them as badly as we think they do. And you'll see what I mean when we look at the first one, which is eloquence. Eloquence is not confined to preaching or preachers, but it might apply to somebody who's talking to a friend or neighbor about the gospel. Eloquence is that character of speech which seems to be perfect, flawless, pleasing to the ear. It doesn't hurt to be eloquent. It's not wrong to be eloquent. In Acts the 18th chapter and verse 24, we see a fellow who was a Christian turning it to the advantage of the work. It says, now a certain Jew named Apollos and an Alexandrian by race, an eloquent man, came to Ephesus, and he was mighty in the Scriptures. Well, he was missing something, and so Priscilla and Aquila took him aside and taught him more perfectly, and the result was, because of his eloquence, in verse 28, he powerfully confuted the Jews, and that publicly, showing by the Scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. Well, his eloquence was a tool that he happened to use, and it was to his advantage. But you look at some who did some of the greatest work for the Lord, Moses, for instance, in Exodus chapter 4 and verse 10, his excuse for not doing what God wanted him to do in freeing the people, going and talking to the people and going and talking to Pharaoh, was that he was not an eloquent man. And he'd never been an eloquent man. Even before he ran off was he an eloquent man. So why send me? And so God took care of that by saying, well, Aaron will speak for you. He's an eloquent man. And so Moses and Aaron did the work that God appointed, but the eloquence was not something that was necessary there. How did Paul describe himself in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 1? 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 1. It says, and I, brethren, when I came unto you, came not with excellency of speech or wisdom proclaiming unto you the testimony of God. Now, when I read the speeches or the sermons of Paul, I find his words hard to believe, because his words are powerful. But maybe he was halting in his speech. Maybe he was quiet. Or maybe he was rushed in what he had to say. There was something about his speech that he didn't think was very pleasing. In fact, in 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 6, he refers to himself as being rude in speech. Maybe it wasn't polished like the speech of a lot of other people. But who did more work for the Lord than Paul? And what I'm saying here is this, that sometimes eloquence can be useful and it's not bad, but it's not necessary. If you're not an eloquent person, if you don't always find the exact right words to say in the right time to say them, that doesn't excuse you. That doesn't mean that you can't do what God expects you to do, because many of those in New Testament times were not eloquent, and they did fine. They did what God wanted them to do. Now, we'll make the observation here. I'll make it now. But the difference sometimes is not eloquence or not being eloquent. It's how hard you work and your desire to get things done for the Lord. And you'll find a way, whether you have a great speech pattern or not. Education is a good tool. It is useful sometimes. But it is not something that is necessary. Now, I know that there are a lot of churches, a lot of denominations that require a seminary education from their ministers. And in order to get in the seminary, you have to have a bachelor's degree in a lot of the seminaries. Some of them you don't, but a lot of them you do. And I know of some places in Churches of Christ where they want an educated man to speak to their people, because after all, they're kind of sort of, they think, educated, and they appreciate the sophistication of that. which is not always an advantage. It's not always a good thing, is it? When I went over to hold a meeting at Miranda Street in Las Cruces, you would not find a larger bunch of just homespun, normal, ordinary people anywhere in the world. They're just down-home country people. But there are, at least when I was there last, about six PhDs sitting in the pews listening to this college dropout preach. That's daunting, to say the least. But you know what? Somebody has to tell you that they're PhDs. They understand that that's not going to be used. Somebody says, in Las Cruces, New Mexico? There's not only a university there. It used to be an agricultural university, but now it centers mostly on space-age stuff. And there's a Johnson Space Center just north of town. And so there is a place for those PhDs to nest, so to speak. But that's not what they use, and that's not what they appreciate in preaching the Word. You look at two, once again, of the most prolific writers and speakers for the Lord, Peter and John. The observation was made about them in Acts chapter 4 and verse 13. It says, "Now when they beheld the boldness of Peter and John and had perceived that they were unlearned and ignorant men, they marveled and they took knowledge of them that they had been with Jesus." Now, some will read this, and there are some of the lexicons that say that when it says unlettered, that they couldn't read, that they were illiterate. And that is a word that is used in some of the lexicons. But if you look at A.T. Robertson, what it means, it seems to mean, now, Peter wrote 1st and 2nd Peter, and John wrote the Gospel and 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and the book of Revelation. They were not illiterate men, but they were not schooled in interpretation and in the law like the scribes were. They did not measure up from an education standpoint to the scribes who were of one school or another and were educated in the nuances of the language so that they could understand the law better, they thought. Okay? And when it comes to ignorant men, they knew what they were talking about. It's just that they were not involved in the politics of the religions of the day. And so they were kind of on the outside, kind of like you and I would be if we went to Washington, D.C. Okay, we're from flyover country. That means when they look down, they see nothing but flies over our country. And so that's what people think of people in the middle of the country a lot of times. They just don't have anything but contempt for them. Well, human education can be good. And anybody that finishes college, anybody gets a PhD, I commend them. There's no point in mincing words about it. They've shown that they're intelligent, they're energetic, and they're dedicated enough to study. But one of the problems sometimes that arises is those who have relied upon human education, continue to rely upon it for answers to spiritual questions. And that doesn't always equal success. Now, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 22 and 23 says, "Seeing that the Jews ask for signs and Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Gentiles foolishness." Anything as simple as the gospel is not worthy of the Gentiles' thinking. And I know a lot of people who are like that, and so do you. Okay, and then in verse 20, same passage, but skipping back to verse 20, he says, "Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world?" The problem sometimes is that we, being humans, become enamored with ourselves and our own intelligence and our own wisdom. And human education appeals to us more than a religious or spiritual education. But now, does that mean that there's no work involved in being a good servant of God? And the answer, of course, is no, it doesn't mean that. In fact, Paul tells Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15, "Give diligence to present thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, handling aright the word of truth." And of course, the King James Version says study rather than give diligence. Both the same thing. The idea is give full attention to what you're studying, to what you are trying to learn so that you might be a worthy worker for the Lord. You know, I know what you're talking about when you go out to teach others. A lot of times, we're not provoked really to study until we're challenged, until we meet somebody who questions something that we believe, and then we just study like crazy. It's good to do a little bit of that studying beforehand and to know where we're headed when we get into those religious discussions. And so we need to be good students of the Bible. We need to learn how to study better. And studying and reading are not the same thing. I used to read the funny papers, but I never studied them, except Pogo. I used to study that a little bit because it was political humor, and I thought that was funny. But I guess the guy that wrote that's dead. Shows you what it's worth, maybe. But anyway, 1 Timothy chapter 4, Paul says this to Timothy. And this, I recognize that Timothy is an evangelist. And I recognize that what he's saying to Timothy has to do with, I think, about two-thirds of what his responsibilities of an evangelist is. He says there, till I come, give heed to reading. Well, when he says give heed to reading, he's not talking about public reading like we do on Sunday morning before the worship. He's talking about reading the scriptures, reading the letters sent back and forth and the comments made by other students of the Bible. Give heed to reading. It's another word for study. Exhortation to teaching. When he says in verse 14, neglect not the gift that is in thee, which was given thee by prophecy, he's not saying that he has the gift of prophecy. He's saying that it was prophesied that he would have a gift. And it was a gift that was his by the laying on the hands of the presbytery. Well, the presbytery is elders, not apostles. These are the apostles that were the ones who passed on miraculous gifts. They were the ones who laid hands on people to pass on miraculous gifts. The presbytery did not do that. There are some gifts that we have that are not miraculous, that we become stewards of in our service to God. And all of us, I believe, have those gifts, or at least one or two of those gifts as we look at them. Just as an example, look at Ephesians chapter 4. And beginning in verse 8, where it says, wherefore he saith, when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive, and he gave gifts unto men. Now, here's a parenthetical statement, verses 9 and 10. Now this, he ascended, what is it? But he also descended into the lower parts of the earth. He that descended is the same also that descended, ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things. Now, that's kind of a parenthetical statement. But now, combine verses 8 and skip the parenthetical statement, and you'll see the sense that it makes. Wherefore, he saith, when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men, and he gave some to be apostles and some prophets. There are miracles involved in that, and some evangelists. There are no miracles inherent in being an evangelist. And some pastors. There's no miraculous aspect of being a pastor. Some pastors have miraculous gifts because the apostles laid their hands on them, but that's not because they were pastors, okay? And some teachers. Now, the gifts that he names there are the apostleship, prophecy, evangelists, pastors, and teachers. The gifts that we have, the talents that we have, the abilities that we have to serve God are the talents or the gifts that he's talking about here. And that's what he's talking about in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 14, where he says, neglect not the gift that is in thee. What gift did he have? He was an evangelist. And it was given him by prophecy. In other words, it was prophesied that he would be an evangelist. And it was given him by the laying on of the hands of the presbytery. There were some who appointed him to that position or agreed to support him in that position, and so they laid hands on him to seal that agreement. There's no passing on of miraculous gifts there. But notice what he says about it. He says, neglect not the gift that is in thee. How can we neglect the gift if we're... let's not talk about evangelists, just talk about teachers of God's will. By not studying. By not using the opportunities that we can to teach others what we have studied. Those are ways to neglect the gift that we have, whatever gift we have, by way of evangelism. And he says, don't neglect it. He says in verse 15, be diligent in these things, give thyself wholly to them, that thy progress be made manifest unto all. If we will give ourselves to Bible study and to learning, then it'll be evident among those that associate with us. Well, there's several fellows here that have become Christians since I've been here, and their growth is evident. Why? Because they study. And that's what they ought to do, and they ought not to be discouraged in it. They ought to be encouraged, and encouraged not only to study, but to use what they've studied in the best way that they can. But the rest of us need to study too. And we need to do as we encourage those who are younger in the faith to do. So when we talk about education, a human education is fine. It can be an impediment, but it's not necessary. But an education in God's Word is necessary. And it's a different thing altogether, isn't it? Well, some people are a little bit backward about serving the Lord because they don't feel like they have the wherewithal to do what they want to do. I'm a little bit confused, and I'll tell you why. I've been in congregations three times this size who didn't have the money for gospel meetings, but we have two a year. And we have a radio program and a television program. Somebody says, yeah, but somebody's contributing. Yeah, but those other congregations had people that could contribute to it, but don't. Riches is not the answer to the question or to the problem of doing the Lord's work. It's a good tool if you've got it. But if you don't, it shouldn't slow you down. The Lord is able to manage not just with the rich, but also with the pure, but the poor as well. In Mark chapter 12, verse 41, it says, and he sat down over against the treasury and beheld how the multitude cast money into the treasury, and how many were rich, how many that were rich cast in much. And there came a poor widow, and she cast in two mites, which make a farthing. I don't know how much two mites are, but it's not very big, is it? Not very much. And they make a farthing, and I don't have any idea what a farthing is, but again, it's very little, very minuscule amount of money. And when he called unto him his disciples and said unto them, verily I say unto you, this poor widow cast in more all than they all that were casting into the treasury, for they all did cast in of their superfluity. I like that word, superfluity. Okay, it means their abundance. But she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living. Well, there's something more to give to the Lord in His cause than money. There is effort. There is attention. There is devotion to it that we need to be giving. We can name disciples who willfully sacrificed wealth itself. And for instance, in Luke chapter 5, we have Levi, or as he is called elsewhere, Matthew. In Luke chapter 5, verses 27 and 28, says, after these things, he went forth and beheld a publican named Levi sitting at the place of toll and said unto him, follow me. And he forsook all and rose up and followed him. Now I see Matthew, or Levi, if you want to call him that. Here he's got this, he's sitting behind a table and he's got these Roman guards behind him with their spears and shields, and they're ready to protect him and exact whatever money he wants from the people that are coming to pay their taxes. And he just gets up like he was going to go pour himself a cup of coffee or something like that and just never comes back. He just left it there. Now, I've heard people say that, well, all the disciples, all the apostles were poor fishermen. Levi was not a poor fisherman. And if he'd wanted to, he could have been quite wealthy. Most publicans were wealthy. And they were wealthy collecting taxes from their brethren. And they could collect whatever they want as long as they gave a certain amount to the Roman government. And a lot of times they collected a lot more for themselves than they did for the government. So they were hated. But he could have been wealthy. But he left it all. The Apostle Paul, I've made the statement many times that he was the rich young ruler. He was not the same individual, but he had the same position. He was rich. He was schooled in an exclusive school, which took money. 1,000 miles away from his home, that took money. He had sway over the council. He was powerful enough so that he could take Christians and put them to death or put them in prison contrary to Roman law, and nobody said anything to him about it. If he had the permission of the priest and the high priest, then the Romans just ignored it. And he was a young man when when Stephen was stoned. He's referred to as a young man who held the coats of those who stoned Stephen. He's a rich young ruler. Well, what was the rich young ruler asked to do in Matthew 19? Go sell everything you have and give it to the poor. What did Paul do in Philippians chapter 3? He describes how he was situated as a Pharisee and a Hebrew of Hebrews in verses 4 through 6. But in verse 7 he says, "Howbeit what things were gained to me, these have I counted but loss for Christ. Yea, verily, I count all blessings to be lost for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I suffered the loss of all things, and to count them but refuse, that I may gain Christ." Now, you think about that for just a minute. Here was a man who could travel about the country capturing Christians and bringing them to jail. And then all of a sudden, he's going around the world begging for money from the churches so he could keep up his preaching business. What happened to all the money? When he became a Christian, he had to turn his back on that money. It was no longer available to him. He gave it up. In effect, he did exactly what the rich young ruler was asked to do. He did it. And what was it that Peter said in Matthew 19 about himself and the other apostles? He says, "Lo, we have forsaken all and followed thee. What then shall we have?" They had done already without realizing it what Jesus had asked the rich young ruler to do. They had put everything on the line for their faith and for their efforts for the faith. Everything was given up. The church also was not afraid to, as a group, to turn loose of its wealth. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 44, we find that the church consisted of a lot of people who were not from Jerusalem, who stayed in Jerusalem because they didn't know what else to do. They became Christians and they wanted to learn more, so they stayed right where they were. And it caused a little bit of problem with reference to finances. And so it says in verse 44, Acts 2:44, "And all that believed were together and had all things common, and they sold their possessions and goods and parted them to all according as any man had need." Well, he's not saying that they all turned communist. He's saying that the members of the church were conscious of the needs of their brethren and did what they had to do in order to see to those needs. We've mentioned the fact that the key to all of this service that we read about in the New Testament is found in 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 5, where Paul is talking about the churches of Macedonia and their contribution to the needy saints in Jerusalem. He says that they were poverty-stricken. They were poor people, and yet they gave beyond their own power. Well, you've heard people say, "Well, you give all that you can, all you can afford to give." Well, they went past that. They gave until it hurt. Now, the reason they were able to do that is found in verse 5. It says, "In this, not as we had hoped, but first they gave their own selves to the Lord and to us through the will of God." They gave themselves to the Lord. If you give yourself to the Lord, He's got your money. or whatever else you have that he needs or that the work needs. But the key to any service is that. Now, what does God ask of us? Look at verse 12. He says, "For if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according as a man hath, not according as he hath not." God doesn't expect you to do any more than you can do, but he expects you to do what you can do. Now, whether they were rich or poor, they preached the gospel wherever they went. In Acts chapter 5 and verse 42, it says, "And every day in the temple and at home they ceased not to teach and to preach Jesus as the Christ." When Stephen was murdered, the people were scattered because they were afraid they were going to be killed too, and they had some reason for that. And it says in Acts chapter 8 and verse 4, "They therefore that were scattered abroad went about preaching the word." Now, does that mean that they raised a lot of money and went out on great campaigns? No. Wherever they went preaching the word. And we get back to this idea of the key to success being elbow grease. The willingness to do what you can do, but you got to do it. Any measure of wealth that we have is a stewardship. God expects us to use it wisely for our own benefit, for the benefit of his cause, and for the benefit of others. But use it. Don't hoard it. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17, "Charge them that are rich in this present world that they be not high-minded, nor have their hopes set on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who giveth us richly all things to enjoy, that they do good, that they be rich in good works, that they be ready to distribute, willing to communicate, laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on the life which is life indeed." So our hearts should be somewhere besides on our pocketbooks. It should be somewhere else. Riches are not necessary as a tool to do the Lord's work. Now, this next tool is fine appearance. Everybody looks fine to me. But I'm kind of a country sort of a person and pretty casual in my mind with reference to the way people are. But I do have an understanding that sometimes we need to not put on a show, but we need to show some respect by how we dress and how we appear before men. There's something that occurred that used to just gripe me to death. "Well, what was it this time, Baker?" And there's a lot of things that sometimes disappoint me. There was a young man who, from time to time, be asked to lead songs, and I worried about it because I knew what he did. He delivered pizzas for a living. And the pizza company had a dress code, a standard of dress that he had to follow if he's going to work for them. He couldn't wear worn-out clothes, in other words. He had a T-shirt to wear that had the name of the pizza company, and he had to wear nice slacks or blue jeans. Now, he could wear flip-flops or he could wear tennis shoes, but they had to be respectable. And what he would do is he'd deliver pizza on Sunday night or Sunday afternoon, and then he'd go home and he'd put on a T-shirt with holes in the armpits and come to church and lead songs. And you know that this character, unfortunately, he was one of the fellows who had to keep time. I'm going to suggest that he not do that because I don't want to look at his holy shirt and whatever you might see through the holes. Now tell me, what does that tell you about his disposition or his attitude toward the Lord and the work of the Lord? I was talking to a heathen the other day. I think it was a heathen. But anyway, he's not a member of the church. But anyway, he was talking about the way people dressed. And he says, "Well, you wouldn't find people going to a funeral or a wedding dressed like they sometimes go to church." Yeah, he's starting to. But do you see the attitude that he was expressing? That when you go to a wedding or a funeral, everybody has enough sense to show some respect for what they're involved in. And people ought to do the same when they go to worship. Now, I asked him, do you wear a coat and tie when you go to church? Well, no. But I don't wear Bermuda shorts and a t-shirt. And I appreciated that. But the point is, you don't have to dress like GQ to go to church. That's not what the Lord expects. And I don't believe the Lord demands a coat and tie out of a person. We had one member here who always wore a coat and tie, and you'd never find him without a coat. And everybody here who knew him, he passed away, respected and have nothing but respect for that man and love for him for his work in the Lord, and nobody ever said he was overdressed. So I asked him, why do you always wear a coat when it's so hot in the building? And I was back when the air conditioners were out on the ground, and it was hot in here. And he says, I'm going to see the king, and I want to dress like it. Okay, that's all I needed to hear. But you look at John the Baptist and his dress in Matthew chapter 3 and verse 4. It says, now John himself had his raiment of camel's hair and a leathern girdle about his loins, and his food was locusts and wild honey. Somebody made the remark to me today already. Two people have made the remark to me about wearing this coat today. Well, it's cool enough in here for me to do it, and so sometimes I'm in the mood. Okay? But this coat is 100% genuine camel hair. So I'm imitating John the Baptist? I don't think so. But the point is, we don't place the stress on that. But what would you think if I showed up like Rick Warren does in Bermuda shorts and a Hawaiian shirt and flip-flops or sandals? If you appreciated it, then I would feel bad about it. I'd feel sorry for you because that wouldn't be respectful. Well, who determines what's respectful? Well, generally men do. But they don't just arbitrarily make up their mind that something is, well, sometimes I talked a couple of weeks ago about the fellow that insisted on me wearing a suit coat when I baptized somebody. You can be nutty, okay? But I'm reminded of Matthew chapter 11, verses 7 through 9 for a couple of reasons. Jesus talking about John the Baptist says, and as these went on the way, Jesus began to say unto the multitudes concerning John, what went ye out in the wilderness to behold, a reed shaken with the wind? John had expressed some doubt with reference to Jesus' identity. And he sent his disciples to ask Jesus. And so you can just imagine the disciples of Jesus standing there and saying, well, what's the matter with John? And he's saying, what went ye out in the wilderness to behold, a reed shaken with the wind? John was not a reed shaken with the wind. But what went you out to see? A man clothed in soft raiment? Put you in mind of Jim and Tammy Faye, Baker, two K's, no relation. And Tammy Faye wore probably 6 or 7 pounds of makeup on her face. And Jim Baker, in spite of wearing a Rolex watch where everybody could see it and big diamond rings and all that kind of stuff, nobody noticed it because of Tammy Faye's makeup and her mascara running when she started crying. But it was their appearance. They wanted to give the appearance of wealth to show what a blessing it was to be in Jesus. Well, that's not the blessing that I'm looking for or many other people are looking for. So where do you find the men wearing soft raiment? You find them in kings' houses. But what went you out to see? A prophet? Yeah, I say unto you, and much more than a prophet. Okay, so here is one who didn't dress in order to impress. On the other hand, we need to use some judgment with reference to that. We might read 1 Samuel chapter 16, verses 6 and 7, though, where it says, it came to pass when they were come that he looked on Eliab and said, surely Jehovah's anointed is before him. This is Samuel looking among Jesse's sons for a successor to Saul. And he thought, Eliab, it's got to be the one. He's tall, he's good-looking, he's well-dressed, he looks the part. But Jehovah said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For Jehovah seeth not as a man seeth, for man looketh upon the outward appearance, but Jehovah looketh on the heart. Now the heart is going to reflect, the outward appearance is going to reflect something of the attitude of the heart. But what's important is the attitude of the heart. Now you look at 1 Peter chapter 3 and verses 3 through 4, where the Lord speaks to women. And I don't want to get into this because I want to get involved in modest apparel and all this because it's a different subject. But look at this. It says in verse 3, whose adorning let it not be the outward adorning of braiding of hair and of wearing jewels and of gold or putting on apparel. The problem there is not that a woman braids her hair or wears jewelry. The problem is on emphasis. He says, but let it be the hidden man of the heart in the incorruptible apparel of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. It's also of great price in the sight of men. People notice. Now, a woman can dress real flashy. She can just be like a neon sign out there, and she's going to get everybody's attention. Or she can dress in the most expensive clothes that are on the racks in the stores, or she might have them tailor-made. But it will attract attention. But what people notice and what people admire in a woman or in a man is their character. And that's where we need to give the emphasis, is it not? Okay. Well, at the same time, we should give our best to the Lord. And not be insensitive to what people think or how people feel about certain things. Perfect physical health. I wish that I could tell you that I was as healthy as I was when I was in my 20s, but I'm not. I'm 65 years old. And some of you ain't so young either. Okay, we're all getting a little bit older. Okay, we're all getting a whole lot older. Okay, but that doesn't mean that we don't have some responsibility, that we can't do something for the Lord. And in fact, there's some experience that comes with age that is perhaps an even better tool than the vigor and vim that sometimes young people have. But you look at Acts chapter 20 verse 31, where Paul points out the importance of energy and how physical health and youth can be a helpful tool. He says, wherefore watch ye, remembering that by the space of 3 years I cease not to admonish everyone night and day with tears. Now, nearly every preacher I've ever known has done that. They have gone to a Bible class or gone to the hospital and waited and waited and waited, or taught and taught and taught. I've had Bible classes last past midnight. And, you know, past the ability to express myself clearly. Coffee gets where it doesn't help. And when I was younger, I remember in Prescott one time, there was a woman who was a member of the church. And bless her heart, she took about 3 days to die. The doctor said she was brain dead already, and the relatives didn't want to let her go. So I sat in the hospital with her for 3 days until they finally decided they're going to disconnect her. And it was exhausting. And it was good that it happened when I was in my 30s, because if that had happened now, I'd have spent most of the time snoring. The spirit is willing, but the flesh gets weak. But that doesn't mean that I can't serve the Lord in my old age or in my senior citizenship. We say that instead of old age. Because I feel just the same as I did 30 minutes ago. But you get the point. Paul went through his life with a thorn in the flesh, or at least the latter part of his preaching, with a thorn in the flesh that we do not find identified in the scriptures. We read about it in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 And beginning in verse 7, it says, by reason of the exceeding greatness of the revelations, that I should not be exalted over much, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, that I should not be exalted over much. It concerned him so much, it was such a bother to him, that he continually asked the Lord to relieve him of it. And finally, the Lord said, no, you've got to bear it. Nobody knows what that thorn in the flesh was, but he also was troubled with bad eyesight. I know all about that. You take my glasses away from me, and where'd everybody go? I can see the colors of your shirts, and I can see a little bit of flesh tones at the top of those colors, and that's about it. I have to put my glass on and make sure nobody's laughing at me because I can't see you're smiling. The only person that I could tell is Carolyn because she has a particular posture that she takes. Particular sometimes being said peculiar. But anyway, the point is, Paul had that. And he didn't have the benefit of glasses. He says in Galatians chapter 4 and verse 12, I beseech you, brethren, become as I am, for I also am become as ye are. Ye did me no wrong, but ye know that because of an infirmity in the flesh, I preached the gospel unto you the first time, literally the former time, which means not the very first time he was there, but sometime in the past he had been there, and he had this infirmity in the flesh. And that which was a temptation to you in my flesh, ye despised not nor rejected, but ye received me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus. Where then is that gratulation of yourselves? For I bear you witness that if possible, you would have plucked out your eyes and have given them to me. There's one place where he says, see with how large a hand I write my own name. Well, what does that mean? It means probably he couldn't see very well. Maybe he was farsighted. I got up to preach one time and the light wasn't very good. This is before I knew that I needed readers. And I got up, instead of having words on the page, there was four columns of dark shadows. And I had to ask Virgil Trout to come up on the podium and read the passages for me because I couldn't see them. And he did a good job. But I had to go buy some readers. Maybe that was what was wrong with him. Epaphroditus got sick serving Paul while Paul was in prison. In Philippians chapter 2, it says that he was a servant of Paul, that he was concerned for the work, and that they'd prayed for him, and he got better. But still, he was a servant of the Lord in that illness. You think of different ones that we have known. For example, you know, I'm just getting away from preachers. The brain is not working like it should, but Fern could tell me who this is. The woman who had the arthritis and her husband. And anyway, the point is, she worked for the Lord. She made calls of people who were absent, and she called me a couple of times when I wasn't there, and she didn't let her infirmity keep her away from church or keep her from doing what she wanted to do. Okay? Anybody here know Bobby Lacoste? Now, I'm not talking about Bob Sr., but young Bob, the last couple of years of his life, he went and held meetings just about every town you could think of and held down a full-time preaching job. But everywhere he went, he drug behind him oxygen bottles because he was on the list for a heart-lung transplant, which he never got, and he died. And I think of others who have had similar infirmities that have preached and have served the Lord well and didn't let the physical... Physical health is good if you've got it. Praise the Lord and use it. Don't abuse it and don't neglect the work that God has given. Okay, now, another tool that we don't need is to have everything convenient and opportune. I hope opportune is a word. I think that it is. It was in one of my dad's sermon outlines that I got the word opportune. That means just like you need it. There's an opportunity there. And you look at Paul and Silas when they preached the Philippian jailer. Where were they? They were in prison. and they had been chained to a wall, and the guy that was holding them in prison was about to kill himself. There was nothing in what happened there that said, preach the gospel to me in big neon lights, but they used that opportunity. What about Jesus and the woman at the well in John chapter 4? And Jesus asked her for water. And he says, if you ask me for water, I'll give you water that you'll never thirst again. He says, well, how can you do that? You didn't bring anything to draw water with. And of course, she's talking about the water of life. Paul before Felix and then Festus, and then Festus and Agrippa. Put his life on the line to do as God told Ananias that he would do. He'd preach the gospel for Gentiles and kings. He did not defend himself. He did not beg for his life. He did not try to justify himself. He just tried to explain what was happening so that he could get a word in for the Lord. He always concluded talking about the resurrection. And Festus could see his preoccupation, and he said, you're crazy. We're thinking about killing you, and you're talking about the resurrection? Well, of course, he'd already appealed to Caesar. Like gold, opportunity is where you find it. We make opportunities. We look for it, and we make it. Sometimes the person that we're talking to has no idea that we're going to talk to them about Jesus. Sometimes we have no idea. But Colossians chapter 4 and verse 2 and 3 encourages us. It says there, continue steadfastly in prayer, watching there with thanksgiving, withal praying for us also, that God may open unto us a door for the word to speak the mystery of Christ, which for which I am also in bonds. Praying for an opportunity. He asked them to pray for an opportunity for him to preach. Well, there's only one place he's going to preach. He's in jail. And he's going to preach to the Roman guards, the Praetorian guard, among whom we find in Philippians, there are actually Christians, saints in Caesar's household. Pray for the opportunity. And you need to pray for the opportunity to teach somebody else. Pray that you find the opportunity. Pray for the opportunity for me. And, you know, sometimes it's in the place where you don't expect it at all. But it's there. And if you're ready, then you can take advantage of it. Now, the Bible tells us what tools we need. And some that we feel are really important are not needed or necessary, but they're good for us. The most important tool that we could possibly have, though, is a will to work, the desire to do what God wants us to do. And if we have that, then there's nothing that we can be kept from. There may be somebody here this evening who's not been baptized into Christ. This is the opportunity to obey the gospel. If you have obeyed the gospel by being baptized, but you haven't been living right, we'd urge you, as the Scriptures teach, to repent and pray for forgiveness. And if we can help you in either one of those things, please make it known by coming to the front while we stand and sing.